Okay, we're going to spend our time this morning on parenting. And those of you that have gone through this know that you don't cover parenting in 55 minutes. But there wasn't anything I really wanted to exclude, so the only recourse was to cram it in. But what I think we'll do is a little bit like we did on marriage and divorce. I'll present some material, but rather than presenting for the entire time, I'll pause and see if you have comments and questions, and then let your comments and questions kind of direct us in the areas that there is the greatest interest. If there is no comments or questions, then we'll go in the area where I have the greatest interest. A statement. And then, do you agree or disagree? The proof of good parenting is found in the effort, not in the results. The proof of good parenting is found in the effort, not in the results. Yes? I've got... Okay, Glenn always does get right to it for us. Appreciate that. Hopefully, okay, we just got to have enough wiggle worms on this, or wiggle words, wiggle worms, on this one. The proof of good parenting is found in the effort, not in the results. Okay, we got an I sure hope so.
There's a stipulation on sometimes you get the effort, and sometimes you get the effort and the results.
Okay. Marvin, you gave me a negative. Do you want to, I'm putting you on the spot, but do you care to share your thoughts for that? He said he believed the proof of the pudding is in the eating.
I know you only have control over your children for a certain length of time. That comes a time when they must make their own decisions. But the decisions they make may be highly influenced by the way you trained them.
And I will say this about Marvin. He's probably one of at least two other people in this assembly that I would just as soon have up here teaching this class as me. Because, and he would say it's by the grace of God, and we don't want to negate that. But all four of his children, from my observations, are good, solid Christian people. And I don't want to exclude anybody, but the other one that came to my mind is Bill Norris could be up here teaching this class. We have two children. We're blessed, but it's because their mother's influence has outweighed their father's influence, and no one's more aware of that than me. Now, back to that question.
I would say with reservations, I agree with that, but particularly those of us who have adopted children in our families or know of adopted children or children who have... And particularly, I'm speaking of those whose mothers were not responsible during their pregnancy for drug use and or alcohol use or things like that, or other physical trauma that can occur. There can be exceptions to that rule.
I worded it carefully so that, at least in my opinion, there's not an absolute. If I add one word to that phrase, then I can wholeheartedly endorse it. And that word would be the proof of parenting is found in a good effort and not in the results. The problem I have with the statement as it stands is that effort is not always good. And the proof of parenting is not simply found in effort. The proof of parenting is found in a good effort. The scary thing about parenting that you know is the report card doesn't come in until after the graduation takes place in some cases. And I started with that statement because many people, and some here, I'm sure, although I haven't talked this week to any particular, are very guilt-ridden by the results, the seeming results of their parenting efforts. Their children aren't in the church. Sometimes their children are not even good citizens. And this makes a very, very difficult thing for some people to accept. And yet it seems to me like the responsibility for our adulthood behavior does lie with us. But we as parents have a tremendous responsibility. One man described parenting as God gives us missiles that are going to shoot some 20 or 30 years further into the future than he's going to allow us to go. And parenting is guiding those missiles so that they'll go in the direction God wants them to go after we're in no longer in a position to have impact. And I think that's reasonably good. It seemed like such a good idea. We were excited. They were on their way. 9 months of anticipation, and then they're here. Now what? Now what? There's been manual after manual written on how to raise children. And while I have not read it from cover to cover, probably one of the most injurious manuals to my generation was the one by Dr. Spock. It gained him great notoriety, but it was full of a lot of humanistic garbage. It seems to me, and Tom Woody's not here this morning, but I believe I can attribute this quote to him when he took, and I don't remember which of his children it was, to a PTA or an open house at school. The teacher was complimenting Tom and Lou Ann for what appeared to be a good parenting job. And the teacher suggested that Tom and Lou Ann write a book on parenting. And Tom very wisely simply said the book's already been written. And that's probably the difficulty that most people have with parenting. For most of us, it will be the single largest responsibility we undertake in this life. And while our roles do change as we get older and our bodies do slow down, you never quit being mom. And you never quit being dad until you die. I quoted from Charlie Shedd last week, I believe it was, when his wife wrote that little note that was on the refrigerator that was kind of a dichotomy. She said, "Dear Charlie, I hate you, love Margaret." Well, Charlie Shedd also in his early writings decided when he was in his mid-20s, and I've shared this with some of you, that he wanted to write a book on parenting. And as is often the case, you know more about this before you have kids than after. So he was going to write this book initially, and he didn't have any kids yet. But he came up with a title, and the title was simply How to Raise Children. But he procrastinated, and lo and behold, they had a child before he could get the book finished. So he went back and changed the title of his book to Suggestions on How to Raise Children. Well, he procrastinated a little longer, much like us, and they had a second child before he got this book published, and he changed the title to Humble Hints on Raising Children. And then Charlie and his wife, I think, were apparently eventually blessed with either four or five children. And as he finally got around to publishing this book after they had had all of their children, the title then read, "Anybody Got Any Ideas?" And that's a lot like parenting is for most of us. We tend to know a lot more about, or we think we know a lot more about this than we do when we get into it. Now, I don't know your approach to child rearing. I don't even know my approach to child rearing, to be honest with you. It just seemed like some basic principles were right, and my wife and I tried to, as consistently as possible, apply those basic principles. Now, I think we did a very good job of that. Others in our home would probably take a slightly different view of that. I remember, and Brandon's here today, but I hope he doesn't mind. I remember in a talk one time mentioning, I don't really remember having to spank our boys very often. When I got home, they reminded me that that was not a correct statement. I still don't remember it, but apparently it might have happened more than it should. Along that line, while I'm giving quotes to people, I think Marvin, I once heard him say this on the idea of spanking or correcting children, that when children ask for it so bad, he just hated to disappoint them and not give it to them. And while Marvin and Melda would probably point out some mistakes they've made, I think all of us would be better off the closer we could emulate some of the many good things that Marvin and Melda have done. Well, I said earlier that the one command we've consistently kept is to be fruitful and multiply, but it does bring it with it some difficulties, and it does bring with it some challenges. We're going to go through some of them, and then we'll stop and make some comments. Our mission as parents, as succinctly as I can define it, is we are to prepare our children for service for the Lord. That's our mission as parents. Sure, we want them to become educated. Sure, we want them to have happy lives. Sure, we want them to be able to make a living so that they can live comfortably. But I can do, and I think all of you that are serious about your Christianity can do, without that, if we have our children prepared to serve the Lord. And I believe that's the whole tenor of Deuteronomy chapter 6, which is often referred to as the Jewish or Hebrew manual for raising children. We're not going to read that entire chapter, but since it is so important, let's go back to Deuteronomy 6 and pick up just a couple of verses. Deuteronomy chapter 6, and to not read the whole chapter is a disservice, but time won't allow me to. I'll begin with verse 4 and read down through about verse 7 or 8. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. Now, that's the statement. Verse 6. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Thou shalt love the Lord with all thine heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. That's what they were to teach their children. That's what they were to teach them. But I want us as parents to notice that in the very end of verse 6, something has to have happened before you can effectively teach them to your children. They've got to be in your heart first. You cannot, in my opinion, successfully teach young people something that you don't passionately believe in yourself first. Because they, even more than adults, will see through that, and it will make a tremendous difference. And one of the mistakes, and as I go through my slides, I'm going to mix because sometimes I want to pull something from one slide to now. One of the great mistakes that parents make is we try to teach our children at a level that we are not willing to consistently live ourselves, and it will not work, and I will go so far as to say it should not work. And one of the things that breaks my heart is parents who have broken hearts because their children have grown up to act just like they have. Don't tell your children it's important to assemble and worship if you're not going to assemble and worship. Don't expect your children to not forsake the assembly of the church if you forsake it. Don't expect your children to be honest if you cheat and you fudge. Therein lies a tremendous responsibility for all of us, I believe. Three family problems. And these could be articulated by different words, but I've chosen these words. Problem number one in parenting and in the family is break down and break up. By break down, I mean poor relationships. And in the context of our lesson this morning, it's poor relationships between parents and children. Break up would be divorce or the breakup of the family. Now, there are some topics that are very difficult for us, even as Christian parents, to discuss with our children. I've discussed some rather sensitive things with some of your children this week, and it has been easier for me to discuss it with them than it is for some of you. It's been easier for them to listen to it coming from me than from some of you. And I don't know that that's all bad, But I do know that the ability to communicate in a non-preaching, non-lecturing fashion is extremely important in the parenting relationship. And remember, communication is oftentimes non-verbal. Occasionally it needs to be verbal, but if I were to put a number to it, for every once we need verbal instruction to our children, there are probably 9 or 10 times we need non-verbal by our examples. The second one that I put up there is the words pace and race. We live at a hectic pace. I don't live at as hectic a pace as I used to, although I'm busier than I've ever been. But sometimes we confuse activity with progress. And we do this especially in the area of parenting. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. In fact, I did it with my sons for probably almost 10 years. They were involved in Little League Baseball, and I was a coach. And I am extremely competitive. So when I took that on, I didn't simply coach to teach them how to play ball. I coached to win. Now, I tried to hide that enough so that I could be a good, compassionate coach, but it was there. I would make up batting lineups on the way driving home. I would change them. If I knew then how to use a computer, it would have been on a computer. And I don't think that's bad. We have many fond memories of that, and I wouldn't trade that for anything. But eventually, they got old enough, and I quit doing that. And I couldn't believe how much more time I had once I quit doing that. Now, I'm not against you having your children involved in these things. I can mention many positive things that can come out of it. I'm simply saying they can be servants of the Lord without ever having played Little League Baseball or soccer. And we've got a perspective here to not confuse pace with effectiveness. Abuse and neglect, I hope that's not a real issue with anybody here. But it can be, especially the second one. Now, abuse may be an issue with some families here, maybe mental. I don't even want to think that way, but in a group this size, that's possible. Some of you came from homes like that. But neglect can be a very insidious thing because it can occur with the best of motives. One of the most difficult or treacherous occupations to have in the raising of a family is to be a preacher or a minister. Because you often get so consumed with that, a good thing, that you forget your children. Sometimes the most zealous Christians, I believe, have the most difficult time being acceptable parents in the sense that they get so consumed and so attentive to everybody else's problems that they forget what's going on at home. And I'm afraid that when we do that, we may have to answer for it. Knowing our children is probably one of the most important things to do, and it's one of the most difficult things to do. I'm going to now go to a passage that I know would be brought up if I didn't, so I'll bring it up, even though it's probably been hashed over many times. The passage in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. That has caused more older parents great anguish and guilt than probably any other passage. I will share with you my understanding of that, and then I'll allow you to make comments on that. I've already said that I believe our purpose as godly parents is to train up our children to serve the Lord. Now, my children may not always serve the Lord. I don't know. I may not always serve the Lord, so they're not in any different position than I am. But if they don't, that will be one of my great sadnesses. And one of my great disappointments. And while I believe that the proof of parenting is a good effort and not always the result, if my children choose not to serve the Lord, it will be very difficult for me to accept the comment that I have been a good parent, because I believe that's the mission. Now, I'm not saying that to make you feel bad. In Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6, he says, "Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." And very briefly, many times we read that and say, we thought we trained them up according to Christian principles. They're no longer Christians, so I must have done something wrong. And that's not what I believe, and I think what most of you understand now that passage to mean. In the Hebrew, that literally reads, "Train up a child in his way." It means to know your child and know his bents, know his character, know his talents, and then nurture that child according to those talents, because no two children are alike. You know that, and I know that. Sometimes parents will come to me and say, "I don't understand what happened. They were raised in the same house, and we raised them the same way, and look how different they turned out." No kidding. They were two different people. Now, we need to be the same in terms of our consistency of principles of right and wrong, but you don't nurture two children exactly the same way, because they're totally different. And anybody that's had more than one child knows what I'm talking about. And if you had three child, they're all three different. If you had four children, they're all different. If you have five children, I don't know how you keep track, but they're all different. This passage says, know below the surface. When a teenager comes into the house, I believe this concept of knowing your children is the ability to not simply take what they say, but to be able to go below the surface. You ask a teenager how they're doing, 9 times out of 10, they're going to say fine. But that doesn't always mean fine. Sometimes that simply means, I don't want to talk anymore, I'm going up to my room, and that's a fluff off. Knowing our children is to be able to look below the tone of that and know when we need to delve deeper and know when we need to back off. Train him up in his way, in the way of his abilities, in the way of his talents, and then he won't depart from this. I don't believe this is a passage that indicates if you train your children in biblical principles from day one until they leave your home, it's a guarantee they're going to be Christians. We know that's not true by experience. Therefore, I don't think we need to necessarily feel guilty when our children don't turn out the way that we would hope that they would, although we feel sad. Does anybody want to comment on that passage or on that concept before I move on a little bit further? I know we've covered that in other studies, but there's people here that we haven't necessarily discuss this with, and I feel very, very passionate that we need to make that point clear. Glenn.
This is a tall order, but can you cite any differences in your two sons on how you treated them different?
No, it's not a tall order. It's just I've got a tough audience for that one. Yeah. But I don't think this will, probably is nothing I've ever said, and I won't say which is which. For instance, one of our sons is very musically inclined, so we can encourage him that direction. One of them is a little more structured in organizing of finances and various things like that, so we can nurture that one. One of them tends to be very creative, so you can nurture that aspect of it. One of them tends to be very thoughtful and organized, and you can encourage that. One would lose his head if it wasn't attached, and even being attached, he has on occasion done that. those are general differences, but they're so obvious. But there's a lot of similarities. One's like his mother, and one's like his father. So you know right now which one you're going to like best. But I imagine every parent could have made almost that same little list that I made. It's just knowing them and accepting them, and then not expecting them to do things that aren't in their natural abilities. Brother Grantham.
We found that one of our children was able to do all right by being almost demanding of him, telling her everything to do. And another child, of course, we did have difference in DNA in our children, because half of them were not. But the other one, just exposing them to the what was right and wrong, they were able, you know, to
sure.
pick up on it themselves.
Sure. Some kids you can push harder. Other kids you push. It's not a matter of pushing harder. It's a matter of pushing differently. In my estimate. Dean, was your hand up?
Yeah, I just wanted to second the motion that we just need to be aware of the differences and not expect the same results from them and nurture the, like you said.
And let's expand that. I think we need to not only be aware of the differences between our children, we need to be aware of the differences between our children and us. And sometimes one of the mistakes we as parents make is we get frustrated when our children don't do something as well as we do it, or we get frustrated when they don't fulfill some fantasy we had of something we can't do but we always wanted to do, so we push them to do it. I mean, sometimes the best advice for a parent is to back off. And my wife does a much better job at that than I do. I tend to be more demanding. Of myself, maybe, but also of other people. And I don't want to get personal, but when one takes that home, you have to be awfully, awfully careful. And I'll just share this with you, and I hope that my family will accept me sharing this. When I'm out traveling, I oftentimes am working with people that have problems in marriage and parenting areas, and Donna has to remind me, in essence, don't always bring your work home from the office and cut us a little slack. And then what she's really doing is cutting me some slack. Cheris? Is that Karis or Cheris?
Wolfred always called me Karis.
Karis, okay.
I could take the step a little further about the differences between us when we talk to our children. We need to, sometimes it's the similarities between us. They act just like us, and we don't like to see ourselves looking sure. back at us. And then the part about in that verse that talks about when he's old, he will not depart from it. The maturity factor that still is going on as we speak sometimes is something we have to depend on to make our efforts be fruitful.
If you have had children leave the Lord, though, or engage in any activity you don't approve of, don't ever give up on prayer. Don't ever give up on prayer. It was Suzanne Wesley. I think she had 18 or 19 children. And they finally all grew up and left home. And someone asked her, isn't it nice to have all that free time? And she said, I don't have as much free time as you would think, because I spend a half hour every day praying for each one of my 18 children. So she spent 9 hours a day praying for her children. I'm not saying that's a formula. I'm just saying, when they're no longer under your roof, you still have opportunities to observe them. Turn to Proverbs chapter 20, since we're close here. I want to look at verses 11, 12, and 13, because oftentimes we say, know your child, but how do you know your child? How do you know your child? How do you get this information? Well, I think Solomon may give us a little clue here in verses 11, 12, and 13. Even a child is known by his deeds, whether his work be pure or whether it be right. Number one, how do you know your child? Just observe what they do. Some are going to have natural affinities for certain things, and that's going to be shown in their actions. Verse 12, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, the Lord hath made even both of them. In other words, you observe and listen. Talk less and listen more. What? I wish these classes today were reversed, because I'm going to ask the young people, what are the keys to being a good parent? And I'd like to share that with you. Maybe tomorrow I will, depending on what I get. But I know in the top five, from having done this before, in the top five and probably in the top two will be listening. Listening. That's what he says. Verse 13, love not sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes, and you shall be satisfied. Not only look, but open them and apply wisdom to them. Be sensitive. Okay. Watch their deeds, listen and observe, and be sensitive to these. Three excellent suggestions on how to know our children. Kids are different. We touched on this. I think I've got a list of two or three here in the Bible. Cain and Abel, two totally different young men. Same parents, same teaching. You can't really say they had a lot of outside social influences. It was pretty slim then. They might have played with different animals, but they played with the same kids. Ate the same food. How could two parents produce two totally different children? Well, they did. Jacob and Esau. Now that one gets a little more complicated, because we see a very direct influence of the mother and father there, don't we? And you see another element in this relationship of favoritism. Isaac's favorite was Esau, and in the mother's favorite was Jacob. What did it do to the family? It was a disaster. Absolute disaster. Now, nobody here is going to disagree with this. Sometimes you just have to ask yourself and make sure that you don't subconsciously have favorites, because some of our children are more like us than others. And there's a tendency, even though we'll verbally deny it, to have a little soft spot in our heart for the one that's the most like us. Or if you've had four boys and finally have a girl, or vice versa, it's awfully easy to spoil that one of the one that's only of a certain gender. Or the baby of the family. You can just take this all the way down. And there's been lots of studies how the oldest and the youngest get the attention and the ones in the middle are neglected. I don't know that that's always true, but there's some truth to it, at least enough that you need to keep it in mind. And then, of course, your kids and my kids. Now, you can get around this by just having one. And that's your choice. In general, I think there's probably more benefits to having multiple children than singular, but there's nothing wrong with having singular. It just carries some special challenges, just like having multiple children carries some special challenges. Parental tendencies tend to be in parenting just like they are in marriage. We tend to copy. How did you learn to become a parent? Well, whether you know it or not, you learned how to parent by watching your parents parent. Now, you either thought they did a good job, in which case you'll probably copy what they did, or you'll think they did a terrible job, in which case you'll probably try to contrast with what they did. But either way, the job your parents did will have a tremendous impact on how you parent. Usually it's subconscious, but it's not always. I would say my advice here is don't overreact and overly copy what your parents did, because you're different than your children, and don't overly pull away from what your parents did if you don't think they did a particularly good job. How can we know the bents of our children? That was what I tried to cover a little bit in Proverbs chapter 20, verses 11, 12, and 13. Now, the Bible talks about good bents and bad bents. I'm not going to turn and read these passages because I want to save some time for a workshop. But Psalms 139, verses 1 through 3 give us some indications of good bents. Psalms 51, verse 5, and Psalms 58, verses 2 through 5 talk about evil bents. Now, not everyone here will agree with me, and I don't really know what psychologists would say, but I really don't care, to be honest with you. But left to our own devices, most of us will gravitate toward evil, is my opinion. Left to our normal devices, most of us will gravitate toward evil. Therefore, children cannot raise themselves, and children should not raise themselves. But that's exactly what our society is asking most of our children to do. But Christian children are not going to grow up to be Christian adults left to themselves. It's going to take a lot of work. Some of that work can be executed in the church, but the vast majority of that work has to be executed in the home. And don't ever expect the church to be able to do what the home consistently undoes, because it will never work. It will never work. I've had some wonderful sessions with the young people this week, and I think some excellent points have been made by them and hopefully by me, and I can already see some of the fruits of that, and I can't tell you how much I admire them for being receptive. But that was only that won't last any longer than that without reinforcement in the home. Okay. Things to do as a parent very quickly. I don't think that's up here. That is. Okay. Things to do. This isn't mistakes, but things to do as a parent. Lead your child to faith in the Lord Jesus. And underline the word lead. Don't push, but lead. Sometimes when our children get to the age of, and we call it an age of accountability, you know what I mean by that, we are so nervous that they're not going to accept the Lord that in all good intentions we start saying little things or doing little things that aren't leading anymore, they're pushing. And be very, very careful about that. As you begin to raise your child, remember what James says in James chapter 1. You pray for wisdom, because you are going to need it. Number 3, and these are my opinions, set limits that are fair, but be consistent and carry them out. Children want limits. Children want them. But they've got to be fair, and they've got to be consistent. And one of the problems that I often see in parenting, and I'm sure I've been guilty of it myself, is letting my emotions and my heart tug at the wrong time, and I bend those limits, and I'm no longer consistent.
Don?
Yes, Dean?
How do we determine if it's fair? Should we ask another parental couple that we feel has...
Okay. Dean's question is, how do we determine if it's fair? I think that's a good... number one, if the Bible says that's something we should apply, then it's a fair limit. I mean, sexual purity is a fair limit. Okay. But I think talking with other parents, talking with people that have been through it, like Bill and Marvin, getting their ideas is good. And the third thing I would say is, if you're still unsure, sit down and discuss it with your children and come up to a fair understanding of what is fair to them. Have them buy into it. Now, you've got to be the ultimate setter of that limit, but I think most children, especially the ones that are represented here, are going to be very, very thoughtful in setting those limits. Now, after they agree to what's fair, there's going to be circumstances that are going to make them want to bend it. You know, and the old adage, you just keep asking and asking and asking, and eventually mom and dad will give in. Kids know that'll happen.
I think parents have to be very careful, though, that they limit the worldly ideas about raising children. I think regarding the body in the Bible, they have to be very careful with what we allow the world to tell us about our children.
Okay. And the fourth one I listed, and we could just make this list go on, but the fourth one I jotted down is do everything in your power to maintain communication with your child as they grow up. And as they become teenagers, it's been my observation that there comes a time when you simply need to be there for them when they want to talk, as opposed to you necessarily always going and seeking them out. Because you'll oftentimes get more communication and more dialogue if you let them come to you than if you are always trying to chase them down. And we've got to trust our kids. That'll be in the top 5 that I get this afternoon. Trust your children. Because children often feel like in the church, that we don't trust them. And what it is in reality is we know what's out there, we know what we did when we were young, and we want to keep them from doing those same things and making those same mistakes so bad that we just harp on them. And sometimes, as painful as it is, the only way for our children to learn is to let them fall down and stumble and then be there to help them get back up. But that is hard for us to do because we know what's there. Many a parent, in my opinion, has ruined their children because they didn't allow their children to make the same mistakes they did that brought them to where they're at. Now that's hard. And there's limits to what I just said. We don't want our children stealing and adultery or fornicating. But just think back of all the things that went into getting you where you're at today. And all those bad things that turned out to be learning experiences. And you've got to allow your children some of that if you're going to expect them to grow. I had one, was that you, Adeline? Or?
Yeah, I had a rule when our children were growing up that they could not take other teenagers in the car with them. Because you hear about these things where a whole car load of kids, you know, they're in a wreck because they're not, they do things when they're together that they wouldn't do alone. And our son told us later, he said, I don't think you should impose this on my sister. I think we're good enough.
And then see what happens. See what happens. I had Janice.
One of the things that helped me a lot wasn't having a lot of rules, because we didn't, but early on I learned that it was a lot more important the most important thing was how God felt about me, not how the people around me felt about me and what I was doing or not doing. I wanted to please the Lord.
A very important thing, I think, especially as you get into the teenage years, but it ought to start earlier, is teach your children responsibility. And for heaven's sakes, quit doing everything for them. Quit doing everything for them. And I probably ought to say to that, some of you whose kids are 30 and 40, quit doing everything for them. One of the things we did that made our vacations so much more enjoyable, and I think maybe helped the boys, you know, you go on vacation and the kids will just nag you for 50 cents, a dollar, and every tourist trap you stop at. So we just, okay, guys, here's X dollars. I'll just make up a number. We're gone for 2 weeks. Here's $30. Spend it any way you want. But when you're done, don't come to us. And one of them would be out in 1 week, and the other one would bring half of it home. Now, that's a difference. But it was teaching them responsibility. We did that with the Nike and the Air Jordan. You know, they cost more than my suits. So what we basically did is, here's X dollars. You can buy a nice pair of tennis shoes. If you want the Air Jordan, fine. You make up the difference. And I don't know that we ever had any Air Jordans. But teach them responsibility and quit doing it for them. If you're older and have married kids, don't do everything for them. Don't bail them out every time. And I'm gonna get in trouble, but I'm gonna say it anyway. You don't do your kids a favor when you bail them out financially or emotionally. Some kids would have been better off if they'd have stayed in jail for a few days instead of getting bailed out, because they never learned the lesson of taking responsibility. Now, there's exceptions to that, and I'm sure you think yours is, and maybe it is, but I warn us very, very much. Be careful and don't do everything for your kids, because it won't last. And they'll never grow up to be what you want them to be, in my humble opinion. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Charles, we'll try to make sure we get some.
The trust and responsibility, I think it's sometimes that we get started too late.
Okay. I'm sure we do.
And the other part of it is that as far as trust is concerned, if you see a problem, don't be ashamed to address it as a problem. As if, you know, well, if you trust me, why are you checking on me? That's not the point. If the problem occurs and it's evident.
Especially when they're, especially as long as they're under your roof. Especially. Cindy?
I had two comments. One was about knowing your child. I know this is a controversial subject, but when you work outside the home from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., you can't possibly know your child the same as the mother or father who stays home with them all day. The second comment I had was if you know your kids, if you're with them a lot and you listen, you talk, and you're out there, you know your kids as friends. And then you're able to trust or not trust and make those decisions on what's fair and what's not fair when they want to go and do things because you know who they're hanging around with.
Okay, very good comments. Very good comments.
If you do everything for them and wait on them hand and foot and do, like I said, like you said, do everything for them, you lose respect, their respect.
I think not only you would lose respect for them, I think they lose it for you. I really do. And this isn't necessarily parroting, but some of you older people, just take this for what it's worth, and it may be round file for you. Some of you are fairly well off. And when you die, there's going to be a significant distribution of assets. You think very seriously about how those assets get distributed. Because number one, a significant distribution of assets has ruined more than one family and more than one person. And number two, if your children are 30, 40, and 50 years old and don't know how to manage money now, giving them a big lump sum when you die isn't going to change them, and it may do them much harm. And there may be a place for some of those assets to go to the church. Rather than to adolescent adults. My dad doesn't have any assets, so it doesn't make any difference.
John, I had a comment about, you know, sometimes it's easier for the teams to come to you than to you to try to talk to them. I'm one of those people that Cindy talked about. I leave at 6 in the morning, I come home at 6 at night.
Right.
And usually both my teen boys are in their bedroom with the door closed doing their homework. But I try to make a point of just speaking in for a few seconds and saying, hi, how's it going, how are your day? You know, just so that they know that I do care and realize that they're alive.
Okay. Well, I think that's better than not sticking your head in the door.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to disagree with you, Dean, but one of the catchphrases of the last 10 or 15 years is make sure you have quality time. Well, of course you want your time to be quality, but there's no such thing as quality time that can compensate for the lack of quantity time. Because we all equate how much time we spend with someone as to how valuable we think that person is. I mean, I can tell Donna, okay, I only got 5 minutes, let's make it quality. That goes real shallow compared to us spending a day together. You'd have been proud of me yesterday. I'm proud of me yesterday. But it was enjoyable, but it was quantity time that was also quality. So don't fall into the trap, and you're not,
right.
But don't fall into the trap, well, I don't have much time, but we do spend quality time. Big deal. I'm proud of me yesterday. But it was enjoyable, but it was quantity time that was also quality. So don't fall into the trap, and you're not,
right.
But don't fall into the trap, well, I don't have much time, but we do spend quality time. Big deal. Big deal. That's like saying, I can't worship very often, but I'll worship 5 minutes and it'll be quality. You know, well, that's good. You want quality worship, but it doesn't make up for quantity. And kids see right through that. They see right through that. We've touched on this idea of mothers working outside of the home, and I think I commented on it a little bit last week. It always comes up in this. I don't think it's automatically wrong for a woman to work outside of the home, but if you have children at home, make sure if you work out of the home, it is absolutely essential as opposed to support the luxuries, because you have nothing any more valuable than your children. and nobody can raise those children as good as you. That's the bottom line. So if the wife's working out of the home out of necessity, I think that's one thing. If the wife's working out of the home so you can have three cars instead of two and five bathrooms instead of one, there may be a priority issue there, in my opinion. Rachel.
I just wanted to say that my mom looks at home. It hasn't been bad.
Okay.
It can work.
And it can work. It can work. And I think a lot of it has to do with the times of the ages of the children and the attitude. But it sure needs to be considered seriously. And I don't think anybody here falls into this category, but I am convinced there are people who want to have children because it's a socially acceptable thing to do, but don't want to raise them once they have them. Because I know too many families that the wife's entire paycheck goes to child support. I mean, there's no financial reason for the woman to be working. Child care, yeah. Daycare. I mean, I don't know what they cost out here, but I was talking to a lady that runs one in Des Moines, and for one kid, I'm about to change jobs, one kid, you get about $500 a month. So if you got three kids, you got to have a pretty good job to have $1,500 take-home pay, and then you factor in the wardrobe. Point is, many times, the attitude makes a lot to do with it. Now, my mom did work outside of the home, but she didn't work until we were up into high school or junior high, and it worked. Well, you be the judge of whether it worked. I shouldn't be the judge of that. Probably was, probably didn't work out very good. Adeline?
What Rachel said, she had her grandmother go to babysit her.
Sure.
And that, I think, makes a big difference.
I think there's lots of things that can be a big difference. And I've seen it work, and Rachel's a wonderful young lady. So what else needs to be said? But I've seen it when the attention wasn't given to it, and the children end up pretty much raising themselves. Pretty much raising themselves. And that's something, just be very, very careful. Back on when you get married, and you're already married, so I'll make this point this afternoon. It's always best if you can live off the husband's salary. Now, maybe the wife will want to work for a little while to get money for a down payment on a house and various things. I don't know that that's automatically wrong, but when that family comes, I sure like a family to have the option of the woman staying home, if at all possible, and not getting themselves so financially strapped. Most of you can remember, because of your youth, you can grow up with only one bathroom. And you can grow up with only one car. And some of you can grow up with no bathrooms. I mean, we don't have to live like we live. Now, I'm blessed, you're blessed, but we don't have to live that way. And if the choice is between that and our children's well-being. Gary.
You talked about setting limits, and as long as they live under our roof, when we set limits, there's going to come a time, probably right away, that we'll be accused of being unfair.
Sure.
And that point has to be driven home, that we may be unfair, but as long as you live under my roof, you do what I say.
Okay, good point. Anytime you set limits, you can be accused of being unfair, just like God's accused of being unfair. Study after study has shown, however, that when children don't learn to live within limits at home, they're probably not going to learn to live within limits at church. If you don't learn to respect your father and mother, you probably won't learn to respect God. So there's a lot involved here. A lot involved here. Fred, can you just yell so I don't have to come back?
I was just going to say, a lot of times when the kids say it's not fair or something, they're pushing it to see how far they go the line. They're trying to find out where the line is. As long as you stick up and show them where the line is, they tend to stay back.
Yeah. Well, my children know if I'm not fair, I'll be old someday and they can get even. So, what goes around comes around.
Oh, I'm sorry. Didn't see you, Leon. In the sixth chapter of Ephesians, we all know that, you know, we're taught not to provoke our children to anger, but we are to teach them, bring them up in the Lord, which means, I believe, that it not only makes a difference of what we say, but how we say it.
Absolutely. And we didn't get to that passage, but I think you're familiar with it. Ephesians 6:4, not provoking our children to wrath. That so often has to do with how we do it as opposed to simply what we do. Just one other brief comment, and I was going to have discussion on this, but we don't have time, so I'll give you my take on it. Should parents force their children to go to church? Should parents force their children to go to church? As long as 18 and under.
Yes.
The correct answer is absolutely yes. Absolutely yes. Because that is something that has to be learned. And I hear oftentimes we just don't want to force our children. Well, if you've gotten to the point where you have to force them, then I submit to you something's been wrong in the preparatory years. Because you haven't taught them the beauty of worshiping and fellowshipping. Now that's harsh, but I don't know any other way to say it. And we learn by doing things that we don't always want to do. And if you want to talk about immaturity, it's people that only want to do things when they want to do them and when they're fun. That is immaturity. So if you want immature children, just let them rule the nest. Was your hand up? I thought it was.
We force them to go to school. We certainly should force them to attend church services.
Okay. Now, the ideal is you don't have to force them, but I think some things have to be learned. Some things have to be learned. Sure. The best way to teach them to go to church is you joyfully do it. You joyfully do it. And let them enjoy it, sure. What are you pointing at?
Lynn?
Proverbs as a whole, you know, if you were to consolidate it down to one book, and also as a side note, with lack of better words, how many conversations of telling people about God is bringing them to Proverbs? You know, I've heard it so many times, people interviewed, well, they haven't made a book on how to raise kids yet. We can disagree with it, just like you'd pointed out Tom had said that.
One last comment. If you want to sour your children on the church, you gripe about the church and you gripe about Christians on the way to and from church.